Hello, you are listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. In this edition of Local Motion, we'll hear several stories from the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange. We will cover a couple of different topics here on Local Motion, which will be kind of an expanded version of the KVNF regional newscast. We will start with a summary of the historic avalanche season that has just recently subsided with the arrival of spring. For 12 days in early March, Colorado experienced some of the largest, most destructive avalanches in its history. To put things into perspective, KVNF News called the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. The CAIC has been issuing public avalanche forecasts since 1973. The CAIC is formed through a partnership with the Colorado Department of Natural Resources, the Colorado Department of Transportation, and the Friends of the CAIC, a 501c3 group. Its purpose is to provide avalanche information, education, and to promote research for the protection of life, property, and the enhancement of the state economy. The CAIC has gone through evolutions over the years and was known as the Colorado Avalanche Warning Center for a time. And a fun fact here in KVNF's 40th anniversary year, KVNF was the first radio station in the state to broadcast the CAIC's forecasts. During the winter, you can hear the CAIC's forecasts daily during Morning Edition on KVNF. We spoke with Brian Lazar, Deputy Director of the CAIC. First, we asked him to speak about the historic avalanche season.
Oh, this was a season for the record book. So, you know, we had above average snowfall, but what really highlighted this season was the historic avalanche cycle in kind of the first 12 days of March, where we saw some of the biggest avalanches we've seen in the state in decades. I mean, those size of avalanches were, you know, running statewide, creating new avalanche paths. You know, and really just in doing an impressive amount of destruction that most of us haven't seen in our careers.
And those 12 days at its peak, how bad was it? You know, I read at one point there were 2,000 snowslides in one day.
Oh, I'd have to look at that, but I would not put that number out of reach. I mean, we only record the snowslides, you know, the avalanches that we observe and record ourselves or that are reported to us. And so that's a small fraction of the number of avalanches. But, you know, we've had thousands and thousands of avalanches reported to us this year. And, you know, just the big ones alone, we saw more in those first kind of 12 days of March, these historic size avalanches, than we typically see in like a 5 to 8 year period. So it was something else.
Help our listeners kind of understand what that distinction means, a big one. What is that defined as?
Yeah, so we rate avalanche size on a scale. And so one of the scales we use is the destructive potential, with one being kind of relatively harmless to people and five being the largest avalanches known to man, which are typically reserved for the big mountain ranges of the world, like the Himalaya, you know, Alaska, the Andes, things like that. And we saw numerous size 4 and 4.5 avalanches this year. So these are avalanches that run, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 vertical feet, take out acres of forest, take out mature timber, you know, that's 200 or 300 years old, create new avalanche paths in the backcountry. So, you know, just taking out entire swaths of forest, and easily big enough to, you know, knock a train off the tracks, destroy structures, things like that.
Some of the biggest avalanches occurred in Hinsdale County, around the Lake City area. Here's how KBUT reporter Christopher Biddle described it.
Avalanches have caused damage to 2 homes in 2 days in Lake City. Hinsdale County commissioners declared a local emergency Wednesday morning in response to multiple avalanches in the past 2 days. At around 6:30 a.m. Tuesday morning, a large avalanche hit the residence of a Hinsdale County sheriff, injuring the sheriff as well as his 2 daughters. Jamie Scroggins is the Hinsdale County Administrator. She told KBUT the home, located on County Road 30, was completely destroyed and that it took up to an hour to recover all 3 victims.
They're all three doing well. They're being held, you know, just for monitoring, but they are in good condition currently.
At around 5:30 a.m. Wednesday morning, another slide hit an unoccupied home. No injuries were reported. Five people from two nearby homes were evacuated, and a recommended evacuation for other parts of the town became mandatory, with several feet of snow having fallen overnight. For KBUT News, I'm Christopher Biddle.
Brian Lazar from the CAIC said that the avalanche activity in Hinsdale County took place on an unprecedented scale.
Quite a destructive avalanche cycle, you know, where houses were taking out, swaths of forest were taking out, buildings were in jeopardy. That type of destructive avalanche, you know, extended into, you know, the Aspen area. We saw, you know, houses damaged in Conundrum Creek and water supplies threatened near in Conundrum and Maroon Creek. And all the way down to the San Juans, of course, where we had, you know, an extended closure of, you know, more than 2 weeks on U.S. Highway 550 over Red Mountain Pass, where we had, you know, upwards of 60 feet of debris on the road for sections there.
Obviously, not one thing is going to cause these avalanches, but can you identify some of the factors that came together just this year to make that 12-day period happen?
Yeah, I mean, in general, and this is, you know, true statewide, more or less, is that, you know, we built up for Colorado anyway, a relatively deep and stable snowpack. And so it was able to, when storms really started ramping up at those last few days of February and into early March, it was dropping feet and feet of snow. And on a normal Colorado snowpack, it would give way. It would fail much earlier in the loading event and produce widespread but much smaller avalanches. The fact that we had such a deep and fairly stable snowpack for our continental snow climate allowed a lot of volume to build up in the avalanche start zones before they finally failed. And so the fact that we started with a relatively strong snowpack allowed lots of snow to build up before reaching the tipping point. And that's why we saw such historic-sized avalanches.
This is a big question, and obviously you can't answer it after 1 year, but I was wondering, was there a role of climate change? Did it contribute to the avalanches?
Well, we can't, you know, tie climate change to any kind of particular, you know, storm or loading event, but certainly these bigger, warmer, juicier storm systems are consistent with, you know, warmer atmosphere. And so we're starting to see kind of storm events that are outside those we've seen or experienced in decades. And so we're going to have to kind of rethink, you know, how we forecast for these really warm, wet events. Yeah, that we may not have seen previously.
And moving forward, was this past season more of a one-time thing, or do you think this is going to be the start of a trend?
That's a really good question. I mean, you know, certainly we noticed that, you know, weather patterns are changing. We're seeing things that we didn't used to see decades ago, like rain on snow in the middle of winter. But you can contrast last year versus this season, where we had quite a dry year last year and quite a wet, snowy year this year, and that type of variability is consistent with some of the projections of climate going forward. So, you know, we're probably going to see a mix of, you know, dry and wet years going forward. And our wetter years could be wetter and our drier years could be drier.
And to bring our look at the avalanche season here on Local Motion to a close, we'll hear KBUT's Christopher Biddle report from Lake City for the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange. This report was filed a couple of days after the dangerous avalanches in Lake City had stopped.
Life is beginning to return to normal for the residents of Lake City, Colorado, after an unprecedented avalanche cycle in early March wreaked havoc on the town. A massive dose of wet, heavy snow is being blamed for the abnormal destructiveness and prevalence of the slides. That fits into what climate scientists are forecasting for Colorado's climate future and could be a sign of what's to come. I visited Lake City just as residents and community leaders there were beginning to pick up the pieces. With most of the danger having subsided, the mood was light, even celebratory.
Today is a little bit of a breather for our community. We've had a hard 10 or 12 days, and so today was kind of to celebrate the resiliency of our community and all get together and and have kind of a small debrief.
That's Christy Borchers, a Hinsdale County Commissioner and a public information officer for the area.
So we have had 18 events since March 5th. Those are various sized events. Some of them we have called avalanches, and some of them have been more sloughs.
At the height of the crisis, 58 people were evacuated from their homes. Power was out in parts of town, and miraculously, a sheriff and his two daughters were on their way to a full recovery after their three-story home was crushed by an avalanche in the early morning hours of March 12th. A few nights after that, as another moist storm rolled through, piling more snow on top of the already weak layers, Carol Robinson and her husband Skyler went to bed.
Not too worried, thinking, well, you know, never had a problem before, right?
They woke up in the middle of the night to a thud.
Got a flashlight. We looked out our bedroom window and we could see this mound of snow had come down off the side of the mountain. And looked
out. We noticed
our
shed was missing.
Skylar says,
used to be a shed there.
Where's the shed? And I looked over and I was like, oh, I guess it's gone.
They went to their basement to inspect the damage.
The back wall was bulging in and the drywall was cracked, and we realized, probably we should get out of the house.
We had a deck that wraps around the house, and the corner post is a 6x6, and that got split right in half.
Like with avalanches all around the state at this time, expectations based on experience were thrown aside.
The avalanche forecasters, and, you know, not to put down their work in any way or anything like that, but, you know, they were not prepared.
That's Bob Berwin, a Colorado-based freelance reporter focusing on global warming and climate science. He covered the March avalanche cycle in Colorado for Inside Climate News and explored how global warming might be affecting avalanche activity. He says the March storm cycle has forced avalanche scientists and forecasters to reassess what they know.
Cars were being hit on major highways repeatedly. Obviously, nobody was expecting that type of avalanche activity. Otherwise, they would have definitely, you know how cautious people are, right? They close the roads when there's avalanche danger, and they blast it, they mitigate it, and so forth.
Berwin says that in Switzerland, after experiencing an abnormal avalanche season of their own in 2017, officials are redoing their avalanche maps and forecasts. His reporting also highlights climate scientists that are finding evidence of extreme avalanches being linked to global warming. For example, in some areas, there's been an increase in what's called mixed debris avalanches, slides that carry uprooted trees and other objects, and often have a high water content.
When an avalanche does release with wet snow, there's just more mass and you know, more weight to the snow. So in some ways, it's probably a more of a destructive force.
Billy Barr is a climate researcher at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory in Gothic, Colorado. He takes daily weather measurements in his area, and his data shows a dramatic increase in water content for this winter's snowpack.
We are this winter, surprisingly to some, 7% below average on total snowfall. But we're 21% above average on snow water equivalent, meaning the amount of water that is in that snow. And so that's a huge discrepancy.
Barr says the two measurements are usually tied to each other so that when the snowpack is up, the water content is usually up by the same amount.
And instead, it's a much denser snowfall by a lot. So you're talking about 7% under and 21% over. So you've got a major difference.
Back in Lake City, Commissioner Christy Borchers says they're only just beginning to assess the cost of the damage caused by the slides.
We believe that we have short-term economic impacts and potentially long-term economic impacts during the spring break time. We had employees out of work with the shutting down of one of the two hotels. Once that happens, it's that domino effect. You know, it's not like spring break is going to happen 2 weeks from now. People will just make other plans.
Lake City's economy is driven almost entirely by tourism. There's fishing and hiking, including on the famous Alpine Loop. But experience says those attractions are likely to be affected by the high snowpack this winter, and one of the town's biggest events of the summer, an alpine race through the mountains, is also in jeopardy.
The San Juan Solstice is a big event for us. It's 25 years old, and we have the regular route, and we have the alternate snow route. And this year, for the first time, the conversation has just been wondering if the alternate route won't work.
All that loss is on top of the money needed for repairs to roads and power infrastructure. It's a shock to this town of only 500 or so year-round residents in one of the most isolated parts of the state and the country. But as global warming advances, this crisis may serve as a warning of what could become a new reality for the residents of Lake City. For KBUT News, I'm Christopher Biddle.
Hello, you are listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. In this edition of Local Motion, we've heard a summary of the historic avalanche season that wreaked havoc across western Colorado in early March. Now, we're going to switch gears and listen to the most recent edition of Connecting the Drops. This is an ongoing series about water and water issues in the West that the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange has been working on for a couple of years. Wastewater and municipal sewer systems around the country are dealing with a growing problem. People are putting things down the drain and down the toilet that are playing havoc with the system. As Maeve Conran reports, several Colorado municipalities have launched public awareness campaigns on what not to put down the drain.
The sound and smell of bacon frying is a pretty common occurrence in households on weekend mornings. Now, imagine this happening in millions of households around the state. Then imagine the cumulative effect of all those greasy frying pans getting washed. It's something Liam Cavanaugh, Director of Operations for Metro Wastewater Reclamation District, thinks about frequently.
If you think about 2 million people worth of wastewater, that's a lot of wastewater. And so if every household is dumping their bacon grease down the drain on Sunday morning, that can cause a lot of problems in the piping systems in here at the treatment facility.
Metro Wastewater Reclamation District treats the wastewater of about 2 million people in the Denver area. The Robert W. Hyde plant, close to downtown Denver, deals with the bulk of it. Pretty much anything that goes down the drain in this area comes straight here to be treated, cleaned, and ultimately discharged back into the South Platte.
So what you're looking at here really is about right now 100 million gallons per day of wastewater flow coming in. And this, what we're looking at, is mainly from areas in Denver and south and west of the Denver central area. We also have another flow over here that you can see that comes from Aurora, Denver International Airport, and areas north and east of this facility. So we have two different influence streams, and we run two parallel treatment processes here at the facility. And then we go through those processes and eventually combine at our effluent that then recharges the South Platte River.
This treatment plant is able to handle the usual suspects that get sent down drains and toilets in a busy urban area like this. But they're encountering a growing trend that's causing problems with the system. Fats, oils and grease, or fog. And it's becoming a major issue for municipalities around the world, sometimes leading to situations like this one in London in 2017.
One of the biggest fatbergs in the world was found in the Victorian sewers below Whitechapel. It was 250 metres long.
Its length was the entire span of Tower Bridge, plus an extra 6 metres.
While Denver hasn't experienced anything close to this scale, fog has become a big enough issue for entities like Metro Wastewater to launch a public awareness campaign. Fort Collins is another municipality dealing with this. They've launched their own campaign, letting the public know that fog can clog. Andrew Gingrich, Director of Waterfield Operations for the City of Fort Collins Utilities, says it's not just grease that's an issue.
We do find a lot of flushable wipes in our system, and it is one of the leading causes to backups that we have, along with fats, oils, and greases. And then there's other things that get flushed, but I'd say the flushable wipes and fats, oils, and greases are our main contributing to backups that we see and the reason for our aggressive cleaning and of our pipes.
those flushable wipes are not so flushable after all, and they're becoming an increasingly large problem for communities around the world. But while they're marketed as flushable, they don't biodegrade like toilet paper does. And then when they're combined with fats, oils and grease, that's when the real problems start.
All that debris starts, and then it just starts to build, and it's a big solid block. I've heard stories of our operators pulling what they thought was a cement parking block out of a sewer because it looked like cement, and it was actually a big congealed log of grease that had just built up over the years.
Andrew Gingrich of Fort Collins says that while restaurants should have a grease catchment system, it's the general public who might be unaware of the impact of what they're doing.
So one of the issues with grease is that typically when grease is poured down the drain, it's hot. And so it looks like it's just going to go down the drain. But when it comes in contact with that other water, either in your home or once it gets to our system, that water is not as hot. And then that grease will start to congeal and then it'll stick to our pipes. And then once you start to get that impediment, then more grease is going to stick to that grease. And that's how you start to develop the fatberg.
So here's a quick rundown of what does and doesn't go down the toilet. Q-tips, dental floss, flushable wipes, dead goldfish. Definitely not. Toilet paper. Toilet paper is, in fact, the only thing that you should flush down the toilet along with the other two P's. You know what they are. And what about down your kitchen sink? Fats, oils and grease? That's a big no-no. Instead, scrape it into a container like a tin can and then dispose of it. Back at the Robert W. Height Treatment Facility near Denver, it's a stark reminder of why we need to be aware of what we're putting down the drain or flushing down the toilet. We're here at the end of the treatment process, and the water, now treated and disinfected, is discharged back into the South Platte River on its way to another user downstream. Liam Cavanaugh, the Director of Operations for Metro Wastewater, says that while people might not give a second thought about what goes down their drain, we really should all pay attention to it, particularly as the water being discharged here makes up more than 85% of the South Platte River flow from this point on.
It's not just the sewer that dumps into the river. There really are downstream consequences of putting things down your drain that can impact our operations and ultimately impact water quality in the river.
For Connecting the Drops and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Maeve Conran.
Connecting the Drops is a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations and Water Education Colorado. Find out more at watereducationcolorado.org. Support is provided by CoBank, which provides financing solutions for rural water systems. Find out more at cobank.com.
Now, we'll hear from Utah station KZMU in Moab, where reporter Molly Marcello put together a feature story about the recent Green River Rock and Mineral Festival. The festival showcases the cultural and natural resources in southeastern Utah.
Can you tell how that's like totally different than the rock around it?
Yeah.
A little bit right here. So that's dinosaur bone right there.
Oh, yeah.
It's early spring in southeastern Utah on a bright, cool day. About 30 people hunch over in the high desert, some squatting low to the ground, looking closely at piles of dirt. It's the Green River Rock and Mineral Festival, and a group of people on a field trip are observing the Hanksville Burpee Dinosaur Quarry. It's one of the largest quarries in the United States, known to hold the remains of at least 15 different dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's the outside of the bone.
There's a bunch of it right over there.
Okay, this is a big limb bone of a sauropod. And this is the dense cortical bone on the outside. You see how thick that is?
Yeah.
You know, that's a big animal. I mean, that would have been a bone about like that big around.
Wow. Utah paleontologist James Kirkland explaining a piece of bone poking out of the soil. Besides Kirkland, just about everyone gathered at the quarry is not a scientist, but they are curious about the ancient world and the fascinating traces it's left behind.
I mean, I'd heard that there were dinosaur bones in the Moab area, but I didn't quite understand where. So sort of wanted to know where to find them. Yeah, it seems like really top secret knowledge, but then when you come out here, it's kind of like, oh, it's just right there. For better or for worse.
Kelsey Kaprowski. To be clear, no one is taking or collecting the bones, which is theft on public lands. Instead, it's quite the opposite. The curators of the Green River Rock and Mineral Festival say they want to help interpret these delicate sites as an educational experience.
It's really important for us And that's why, like, literally scientists are taking people to these sites and teaching them about them, about how delicate they are. Because I think people are going to go to those places anyway, but if we can, like, introduce this educational component, hopefully people are going to have more respect for them and, like, think twice before they damage a site.
Maria Sykes, the executive director of Epicenter. The nonprofit is based in Green River and focuses on rural development and cultural exploration in southeastern Utah. We talk in her truck as she drives the sometimes unforgiving roads to the Haynesville Quarry. Epicenter started the Green River Rock and Mineral Festival 3 years ago as part of an initiative to create some new events during the slower tourism season. Sykes tells me the idea came from some passionate artists and a lapidary. Then the Green River community got behind it. Epicenter secured some funding, and the festival has grown every year. They hosted 9 field trips over one weekend during the recent 2019 Fest, all led by the region's top experts on rocks and minerals. Big names like Dinosaur National Monument paleontologist Rebecca Hunt Foster, rock art researcher Steve Asserson, and Bureau of Land Management regional paleontologist Greg McDonald.
There's just like all these incredible sites in and around Green River that a lot of people don't know about. And then we were also connected to a lot of the people who had either like uncovered these sites or they were just experts on these sites, and they were willing to lead field trips, which is just really exciting. And even for like local residents, they're like, oh yeah, I've been to Fossil Point, but I'm like, have you been to Fossil Point with Greg McDonald? Because when I went, like, he like painted this incredible story, and all of a sudden I just understood like what had actually happened in this site where there was this riverbed and all the dinosaurs and like what, you know, all the different layers and what was happening. And now I can go out there and like share that with people whenever they visit Green River.
State paleontologist James Kirkland says Utah is a very exciting place right now when it comes to dinosaurs. Paleontology in Utah is an active field, with new discoveries and new knowledge coming in every year.
You know, when we first described Utah raptor, there were 20 dinosaurs known by name in Utah. Since then, it's not all me, this is the Grand Staircase stuff, but this is all the, you know, Moab area stuff that we've discovered. We've found over 100 new dinosaurs in the last 25 years in Utah. So right now, about one in every 10 dinosaurs known in the world is known in Utah. We have a history from the first dinosaurs to their extinction that's unrivaled on planet Earth.
Kirkland has personally named many of the dinosaurs found in this region.
Utah raptor, Gastonia, Martha raptor, Ned Colbertia, Myrosaurus, Gemini raptor.
I ask him what it's like to get to name a new dinosaur.
Oh, it's a blast. It really is. I mean, I've got several new ones I'm working on right now in my lab from right around here, and other people do too. There's probably 25 dinosaurs in labs in Utah right now that haven't got names on them yet. You know, we got a good fishing hole and people have become aware of it.
Back at one of the so-called fishing holes, festival participants continue spotting evidence of a perfectly preserved river ecosystem from millennia ago. In addition to bone chips, there are petrified logs and freshwater clams, amazing specimens to see in the dry, sandy desert. Squint, and you can almost imagine the ancient river channel, flooding at depths up to 50 feet, capable of knocking down a local sauropod.
And you can see how coarse this river is. You know, these are big gravel channels. This is a big river system. During its flood stages, it can knock over the biggest dinosaur. Doesn't matter how big a dinosaur you are. This thing was in, you know, roaring flood stage. You weren't crossing it. Now, there's a bone right here.
The group spends the afternoon with Kirkland exchanging stories and learning more about the other world right beneath their feet.
Thanks so much for joining us here on Local Motion, KVNF's weekly public affairs show. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.